Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Tuesday, the 5th of January. A very good morning to you and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, Garissa University in northern Kenya reopens 9 months after 148 people were killed in a raid by Islamist militants. There is a promise of better security.
We have put our police post, there are about 25 police officers, and we hope that will be tight enough to help us secure this university.
Later today, Zambia is expected to confirm the date for a general election this August. We look at the human cost of the slump in the copper industry.
That small income that was coming in has stopped coming, and it's very difficult. Right now, I don't even know how I'm going to get the money to pay for my 2 kids' school fees.
We also have stories from Central African Republic, Uganda and Cameroon. Stay tuned.
Top story.
In northern Kenya, Garissa University College has been formally reopened 9 months after 148 of its students were killed in a raid by Islamist militants. The Somali extremist group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack, saying it was retribution for the Kenyan military presence in Somalia. The decision to reopen the campus was accompanied by promises of tighter security. From Nairobi, James Shimanyula reports.
The main gate at Garissa University College campus reopened on Monday, 9 months after being targeted by the Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab. The university registrar Isaac Mohamed Noor confirmed that more than 200 members of staff reported for work. Noor said students are expected to report for classes beginning next week. Speaking at the university shortly after it reopened, Principal Professor Ahmed Wafa said heavy security measures have been put in place at the university campus.
We have put our police post, there are about 25 police officers, and we hope that will be tight enough to help us secure this university. We also plan to put a perimeter wall.
Garissa University is located in Kenya's remote northeastern region on the border with Somalia. Al-Shabaab militants raided the campus in April last year and gunned down people they identified as Christians. The 15-hour siege ended with the security forces killing the four attackers. Shortly after the attack that claimed the lives of 148 students, the 700 surviving students were readmitted at Moi University, west of the capital Nairobi, to complete their courses. Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto underscored the importance of stepping up security at the university.
As government, we are going to make sure that all these facilities that have been put at the disposal of the children of Kenya, for there to be learning at the university level in this institution, will continue. We will make sure that there is adequate personnel to man and to guarantee the security of the students, the community, the teaching staff, and this town and county. We're not willing, we're not prepared to cede an inch of Kenya to criminals or terrorists. We will defend every inch of Kenyan soil.
The attack at Garissa University was the worst in Kenya since Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists blew up the United States Embassy in Nairobi, killing more than 200 people. The Islamists are targeting Kenya over the presence of its peacekeepers in neighboring Somalia. The Kenya government therefore embarked on the construction of a security wall along its 700-kilometer border with neighboring Somalia with the hope of keeping the militants away.
James Shimanyula. The question, of course, for students, academic and other staff at Garissa University College is how safe they are going to be once the university campus has filled up again. I put that question to independent Kenyan political analyst Brian Wanyama.
The safety of the university students as well as the staff is a point for one to ponder about, because a number of issues have been put in place. One is that within the campus itself, there has been established a police station that will take care of student security. And then two, there is now increased frisking of anybody, any student or staff entering and leaving the university. So in a way, that may create some situation of security in that particular area. But we all understand, we are all alive to the fact that in the northern front of Kenya, there have been serious security challenges. Since the Garissa massacre, we've had lots of other challenges. A week ago or thereabout, we had two security officers who were massacred by the Al-Shabaab. Their vehicle was set on fire, and unfortunately, the soldiers were also set on fire.
There was criticism at the time that the Kenyan security authorities didn't react fast enough when the raid started. Have security procedures now been tightened up?
From where I stand, I want to believe that there is now enhanced intelligence gathering and sharing, so that in case of such an occurrence, then the response time will be really a record time. And then two, it will also be good that the raid company, the elite squad and company that resides in Nairobi, I'm sure now the government has put the mechanism in place where they've been provided with standby helicopters, because that time the response was delayed because apparently the helicopters were not available for use by the elite forces.
Was the Kenyan government directly involved in the decision to reopen this university?
I do believe that the government was involved in the reopening of this university. Two key issues here. One is that the reopening of Garissa University is a show, a depiction of confidence on security issues, that there is the need by the government to depict the fact that Al-Shabaab cannot cow down the government. You know, closing the Garissa University totally would have been an acknowledgement of being defeated by a terror group. Two, there is the element of the political boost especially for the communities that stay in the northern frontier. You know, Garissa University is the only university in the northern frontier. So by reopening it, the government is affirming its readiness to work with people in the northern frontier. But on the political front, to come to the question very quickly, the announcement about the reopening of the university was done by none other than the deputy president, William Ruto, in one of those political meetings.
How have Kenyans themselves been reacting to this news? Do they think it's a good idea to reopen the university?
It is a 50-50 situation. There are those who feel, well, that perhaps the reopening has come too soon before people have overcome the trauma that they went through. And then we also have another group that feels that fine, by reopening the university, basically it's saying that in spite of the terror attacks and the harassment and the killing of Kenyans, life still has to go on, because by closing up the university, the government would definitely be acknowledging that now it cannot keep up the Al-Shabaab attacks.
Political analyst Brian Wanyama.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
With vote counting still in progress, partial results from the elections in Central African Republic are putting a former Prime Minister, Faustin Archange Touadéra, in the lead to become the country's next president. The elections were held last Wednesday in a bid to turn the page on years of interreligious violence. I've been talking to the political commentator Ayo Johnson, who is the director of Viewpoint Africa in the UK. Touadéra was a former prime minister under long-running president François Bozizé, who is now in exile. What more could he tell us about him?
Well, he's 58 years old. He used to be a former math teacher. He's had extensive experience in government and governance. He's led in government, and he's highly respected. And above all, it would appear that the people of the Central African Republic have gone for experience, which he clearly has, but more so for security. He's one who's been in government. He's shown that he understands the elements of governance, and he may be able to rally in international support and above all donors who are required to help the Central African Republic get back on its feet.
How close are his ties to Bozizé, who is now living in exile and who was banned from taking part in these elections?
Well, yes, he's got close ties with Buzize. He's worked in government with Buzize. He's clearly supported Buzize's objectives in the past, not to say that he supports those right now. In fact, he's standing very much as an independent outside of the established political parties, which in a sense has been in his favor because people see him as someone who's slightly reformed, slightly different in his own approach to governance, but quite different from Buzize. But the element of Buzize and the rule that he did for which Touadera was clearly part of would one that people would tend not to forget.
Why then has he taken this commanding lead?
Well, it's come as a bit of a surprise, but it would appear that the front runners, if you're looking at Touadera and if you're looking at Dologele, these are all government ministers of past. These are people who've been in government. They've led teams. They've got extensive experience. They know what they're talking about. And they're not individuals who are coming on or sort of not knowing what to expect. And I think in terms of Touadera, he's clearly someone who the governance, in terms of the vast majority of Central African Republic population, especially those who voted, are voting for him, are thinking that he has the experience, he has the knowledge, and he has what Central African Republic clearly needs now, which is governance.
But these elections aren't over yet. There could be a runoff on January the 31st. But what's your assessment of the elections so far? Are they going well?
Well, we can see that Central African Republic has come through a very trying time in their history. And to get to where we are now, despite all the expectations that we may have problems which we haven't seen, that the elections will never happen, which they have, and that it would not be peaceful, which it clearly is, I think Central African Republic can stand high and they should be very proud of themselves for achieving what many thought would be very difficult.
Aya Johnson, Director of Viewpoint Africa in the UK.
Africa on the Move.
If you are an African musician, how do you market your music? In Cameroon, pianist Ruben Binam is working on the answer. It includes good organisational skills, a willingness to embrace new technology, and a sizeable dose of determination, as we hear in this week's edition of Africa on the Move, written by Matthias Billinger and read by Privilege Mushaniri.
Ruben Binam's backyard is a meeting point for Yaoundé's vibrant music scene. The band Kermit 7 practice here every day. They have even brought their Afro jazz to European stages. Besides his passion of making music, Binam, however, feels that it is his role to pave the way for Cameroon's other musicians. While rehearsals and performances are very important, somebody also has to take care of the business. This is why Binam founded the label Alu's Equator Records. He is now a full-fledged producer.
I'm sure that entrepreneurship can solve the musicians' problems. Artists in Cameroon have been waiting for too long for other people to find the solutions.
Piracy is one of the biggest problems musicians face in Cameroon. Cameroon's first paid internet streaming service has just launched. Ruben believes this could be helpful, but only under certain conditions.
Digitization is a solution. If we can offer the people what they want and do this on a legal basis.
As a producer, Ruben Binam's biggest commercial success to date is the band Ex Malaya. The boy band is famous in Cameroon. Like in many other African countries, in Cameroon, the music industry now makes more money through ringtones for cell phones than music albums. Streaming online has also opened up new markets for African musicians, especially those targeting the African diaspora around the world. Aware of the potential, Ruben and his colleagues are trying to keep up with the modern marketing strategies. For this, they don't need a lot of space. A small room on the ground floor of Ruben Binam's house is the cell's headquarters, programming room and studio all in one.
I am lucky to be someone who can organize things. That's why I always manage to do my own music in between.
And there is nearly always time for a small jam session in Ruben's studio. If all goes well, this song too will end up on his online music platform.
And that report was written by Matthias Bullinger. In Zambia later today, President Edgar Lungu is expected to approve a key amendment to the constitution. Among other things, the change will confirm August the 11th as the date for the country's next parliamentary and presidential elections. The struggling economy is likely to be a major campaign issue. The copper industry is suffering badly, and more than 7,000 miners have lost their jobs in the past month alone, as weak commodity prices and electricity shortages take their toll. Kathy Sikombe reports.
It's another busy day in Kitwe's central business district, located in the mineral-rich Copperbelt province. Though residents are putting up brave faces as they go about their daily activities, not all is well. Recent job losses are the talk of the town. Copper accounts for 80% of Zambia's foreign earnings. Since 2003, it has been the main driver of Zambia's steady 5% annual economic growth rate. Copper is a key metal in the electronics and building industries, but the global economic slump has seen international copper prices tumble from record highs. In response, thousands of miners have been laid off, expansion projects put on hold, and mining operations closed. Humphrey Chisenga, 35, is one of the miners retrenched by Mopani Copper Mines in Kitwe.
That small income that was coming in has stopped coming, and it's very difficult. Right now, I don't even know how I'm going to get the money to pay for my 2 kids' school fees in January and my other dependents.
Walia Kantu is the representative of the retrenched miners. He says miners in Zambia get an average of 500 euros monthly, which is not enough.
My salaries are barely enough. After I lost my job, they gave me a payslip and they gave me what I'd earned in my 4 years of employment. And they told me all this money has been sent to the bank, and I was going away with nothing, totally nothing.
The president of the Mine Workers Union of Zambia, Chishimba Nkole, says the situation is a national crisis which needs urgent attention.
The problems facing mining companies call for urgent measures to bring all stakeholders together with a view of finding immediate solutions and should not be left to only the unions and mining houses. While the issue of job cuts in the mines may be trivialized or politicized, the problem is real and should not be glossed over because people's livelihoods are under serious threat.
Zambia's mining minister, Christopher Yaluma, has acknowledged the crisis and says more dialogue is needed to resolve it.
We will endeavor to ensure that our policies are consistent and that the investors who are in the country and those who are coming to the country won't be greeted by a new abrupt or ad hoc pronouncement. If we are very closely, you know, engaging each other and interacting, you know, proactively, we would have avoided this. But be as it may, it was the lack of that close dialogue, close, which could have helped us.
Analysts say Zambia's copper is expensive to produce and investors are reluctant to start new mines or expand existing ones because of constantly changing policies and taxes.
Kathy Sikombe reporting.
Making a difference.
In Uganda, people with disabilities are often forced onto the margins of society. They face discrimination, which can prevent them from finding a suitable job. In this week's Making a Difference, we meet Fred Butterley. He's helping people with disabilities by encouraging them to acquire skills in arts and design. This report by Nadina Schwarzbeck is read now by Sela Onoko.
Traffic in the Ugandan capital of Kampala poses a challenge to everyone. But it is much worse for people with disabilities, like Fred Butterley. He contracted polio in early childhood.
I was born in a poor family. So at the age of 5, I became disabled. So I couldn't get money to get a tricycle or a wheelchair. So I had to crawl on my knees every day going to school.
Butterley struggled to finish school, but he won a scholarship to study industrial and fine arts at Makerere University and is now employed by an artist's agency. After work, he often roams the streets of Kampala in search of other people with disabilities to win them over for his disability art project. His motto, never be defeated by your disability.
I thought because I had acquired some knowledge in art and design, I thought I could use this as a tool at least to empower my fellow people with disability to get the skills which they can use at least to sustain themselves.
During the weekend, he uses the agency's premises to meet people with diverse disabilities. They create and sell unique products like jewelry, watches, and writing pads. Interest in the project has been growing. It is estimated that 80% of the disabled in Uganda are unemployed. But the project is not just about money. Those participating also learn from each other. They have a social life, which is not given for disabled people in Uganda, emphasizes project manager Butterley. He has been financing the initiative himself, and since money is always scarce, he makes a virtue out of necessity by using materials found on the streets, including waste. The artists have even fashioned a clock out of bottle caps and other waste.
We are trying to come up with this product to be our signature product. It is unique. It's about recycling, which is very good. We have a challenge in Kampala of disposing these bottle tops everywhere. So we are trying to make them into use.
Apart from protecting the environment, this strategy allows the project to survive, which is something that has turned out to be essential for Butterley.
This project is something I feel in myself that it's my work. It's something I feel I should do it. And I even dream about it.
So far, Butterley was able to only find one private sponsor. But the Kampala City Council is giving serious thought to funding the disability art project. The project's participants hope to be able to move out of the borrowed premises and into their own headquarters very soon.
And that report was written by Nadina Schwarzbeck. A reminder of our main stories. In northern Kenya, Garissa University College has been formally reopened 9 months after 148 of its students were killed in a raid by Islamist militants. In Central African Republic, two-thirds of the 30 presidential candidates have called for a halt to the vote counting, claiming there were irregularities in Wednesday's elections. Two former prime ministers were in the lead after a third of the votes had been counted. And later today, Zambia is expected to confirm the date for elections this coming August. And there we end this edition of Africa Link. Do let us know what you think of our programme. Send a text message to country code 49160957595510, an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. From me, Mark Caldwell, bye now.